Hello and welcome into another episode of the Future Sox Podcast. My name is Mike Rankin. Today I will be joined by senior writer James Fox. He's with us, and we have a very special guest joining the podcast discussing everything internationally regarding the Chicago White Sox. It's Baseball America's Ben Badler. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you guys for having me on.
So I guess the first thing that I wanted to kick things off with is the recent article you put out, and you talked specifically about the White Sox 2019 international class and highlighting that, of course, is Yolbert Sanchez, the shortstop, as well as Elijah Tatis. Could you just kind of, for our listeners, describe the class?
Yeah, I think it was kind of a smaller class than, a lot of other clubs. They had obviously traded away some of their bonus pool money this year, and pretty much probably about half of it, if not even a little bit more. I'd have to look at the exact numbers, but, you know, they gave $2.5 million of it to Yolbert Sanchez, a 22-year-old Cuban shortstop, and then Elijah Tatis, the younger brother. I don't know if I want to, talk too much about his older brother. I don't want to bring back any nightmares or anything for any of your listeners, but obviously the younger brother of the Padres shortstop, Fernando Tatis Jr. So, $400,000 for him. So, combined about $3 million for those two players who, and Tatis, in his case, he's, 18 years old, so he would have been eligible to sign the previous signing period. So two guys who are, not that Tatis is like super old or anything like that, but, two guys who are not like your traditional July 2nd type signings are the two guys they gave about, combined $3 million to this year.
All right, Ben, this is James Fox here. So the White Sox have always been kind of risk-averse in the 16-year-old international marketplace, I guess I would say. They've spent money on older prospects before, but they never really seem to go into that $2 million to $4 million range on the younger guys. Some of our readers, myself included, were upset that the White Sox traded over $1 million again this year instead of spending it. So I guess my question to you would be, so their answer was that they didn't have targets lined up, which, some people thought was unacceptable. Could that have anything to do with the effect still of not knowing what signing period Luis Robert was going to be in, and they just didn't have deals lined up? Or do you have any explanation for that?
Yes, as far as the trading away, bonus pool money. I agree with that. It's something where I actually think that the value of international bonus pool space right now, or starting in 2019, is greater than it's ever been before. In previous years, teams could just blow past their international bonus pools. So it's like, well, why would we trade for more money other than maybe to lower our tax bill, or to squeeze out maybe a little bit of an extra signing if we don't want to go over our bonus pool? But mostly you had teams just blowing past their bonus pools, and they don't really need to trade for pool space. In fact, I think one year the Dodgers, if I remember right, actually went over their bonus pool and just traded away their bonus pool slots or their bonus pool space because they didn't really even need them. And then you had a period of every other year where, you had about 10 teams that couldn't even sign anybody for more than $300,000. So there wasn't a lot of value that teams were getting from trading away their international bonus pool space. Whereas now, there's no more teams under that $300,000 penalty. Everybody is hard capped. You can't go over your pool space anymore. So that pool space is more of a scarce resource than it was before. And we kind of saw this already this year with the Yankees, who, they signed Jason Dominguez, our number one, or is going to be our number one international prospect this year in the 2019 class. But they were trying to sign John Diaz, another really talented outfielder from the Dominican Republic, and they couldn't come up with a trade to be able to get more bonus pool space and to sign Diaz, and he ultimately ended up signing with Tampa Bay for $1.5 million. So I think there's more value than ever you know, if you're holding out for the right deal to trade away your pool space. But, you know, in the White Sox case, it seems like they just sort of dumped it away and didn't get much in return on value there. So, you know, what I think they certainly have plenty of time to, you know, after they signed Luis Robert to know what was, you know, this was going to be the year that, you know, they're going to be free to spend again without restrictions, you know, other than the hard cap that everybody's under. So I think it's, you know, it's also a situation where, yeah, I mean, you know, even if you don't have somebody, say, you know, right now where you want to spend that money on, there's still players who pop up. I mean, you know, the White Sox have clearly been, you know, aggressive in signing and very active in signing Cuban players. And there's a lot of guys that, you know, come out of Cuba and kind of come out later, I guess, in the process now, just because the reality of the international market is teams are, you know, are lining up deals with the players, you know, a year, sometimes 2 years in advance of when they're eligible to sign. Whereas, you know, you can do that with a Dominican and the or a Venezuelan player, but, you know, with a Cuban player, you kind of have to, you have to wait until the player actually leaves Cuba. So it can, you can have Cuban players who come up later in the process. You can have, you know, even Dominican and Venezuelan players, or Mexican players, or players from other countries. There's some interesting guys every year coming out of the Pacific Rim too. So, you know, you can have some guys who develop, you know, quote unquote later. You know, I put that in quotes because they're still, you know, 16, 17 years old, where, you know, you might end up signing them a little bit later on in the process after July 2nd. So, it's something where I think the best teams are maximizing every dollar that they can in their bonus pool. So for, you know, for the White Sox, you know, really not their international parts, really more their, you know, the front office to, you know, to trade away that bonus pool space, I think is probably not maximizing the resources that they have.
Yeah. I mean, I think we would agree with you on that. I mean, they said, you know, that they traded the money away because it was going to go unused and they didn't have anybody to sign, but I think that's the root of the problem. So I guess to follow up on that, how is Marco Patti generally thought of throughout the industry? I mean, he signed Luis Robert, Fernando Tatis Jr., as you mentioned, and Mike Rodolfo, like when he first came on board with the White Sox. And I, you know, I've heard that Marco's fairly highly respected, but they don't spend money like other teams do.
Yeah. They haven't, you know, like when they went over their bonus pool that year, it's not like they were the, you know, you've seen teams like the Cubs, the Rangers, the Padres, you know, probably about half the league, I think, went over their bonus pool at some point to sign a whole bunch of players. And in the White Sox case, you know, they certainly spent money, but it wasn't like they had one big year where they just blew it out. It was just, all right, Luis Robert is available. And obviously Marco Patti was enamored with Luis Robert. And I don't recall exactly where we have him on our top 100. I'm sure he's top 10. I'm pretty sure he's a top 5 prospect in the game. And obviously that signing comes down to a lot more than just Marco Patti, but, you know, it was largely driven by his, you know, his belief in the player. And I think that's certainly paying off so far. I mean, you look at, you know, Jose Abreu, another signing again, obviously in Abreu's case, it's not just Marco Patti going in and doing a deal with Jose Abreu's agent. That one's going way higher up the chain. But you know, in Abreu's case, I remember watching him play when he was in Cuba, and I did like him quite a bit. And then obviously the numbers were pretty jaw dropping. But there, you talked to a lot of scouts about him. Scouts were really good and have been doing this for a long time. And there was a pretty big split camp on Jose Abreu back before he signed. There were people who thought he was more of a 4A type slugger, who had a lot, and people had a lot of questions about how it was going to translate against major league pitching. But obviously the White Sox and Marco Patti were right on that one. And then you mentioned, you know, Fernando Tatis Jr., where, I mean, I'm trying to think of the, you know, the best players. Again, I don't want to upset too many of your listeners, but you think about the best international prospects who've been signed in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, and it's kind of hard to judge the guys who signed from, 2016, 17 on. They're so young in their careers, although obviously Wander Franco looks pretty damn good. But he's got to be up there in terms of one of the best international free agent signings of the last decade. And, I think certainly in his case, too, he was another one where, maybe where Abreu was more of a split camp guy, and obviously a way different kind of player, being major league ready, in his mid late 20s at the time he signed, whereas Tatis Jr. was a 16-year-old kid. But in Tatis Jr.'s case, there were a lot of teams. In fact, I would say the majority of teams really were not all that psyched about Fernando Tatis Jr. when he was an amateur player. I think the White Sox valued him significantly, significantly higher than the rest of the industry did. I think he was just he was a long, lanky kid, didn't have a lot of strength, didn't have a ton of tools. The swing was a little bit awkward, but I mean, you look at him now, and I mean, he just looks totally different. He had strength projection at the time. Just looking at his body, broad shoulders, looked like he was going to get stronger and the tools would have a chance to tick up. But, I mean, he's running 2, maybe 3 grades faster now than he was as an amateur. Power is way up. The swing is shorter. Everything is better. The defense is better. The arm strength is better. So, I think, with any signing, there's some amount of luck involved, and that's probably, that's certainly the case. And with Tatis, that there's some amount of luck in being right. But I give the White Sox a ton of credit for being right on Tatis, on a guy where a lot of people around the industry were really not on him at all. Now, you look at other guys where, they spent money on guys like, Franklin Reyes or, Josue Guerrero, and, some 7-figure signings that doesn't, certainly are not trending in the right direction. But I think you probably look at every organization where, when your job is to make decisions on kids who are 16 years old, and, in reality, especially now, the decisions are being made at 15 or sometimes even 14 years old. You're gonna have your misses. You're gonna have your share of mistakes, but certainly those guys we were talking about, Abreu and Tatis Jr. and Luis Robert look pretty good, I think.
Ben, that was a lot of really good stuff there, and you mentioned a few specific White Sox players, obviously. And when I look back, and obviously there's something there that the White Sox have seen that they wanted to jump on when it comes to Fernando Tatis Jr. and the players of the like. Currently, we're really focused as fans now on Luis Robert, of course. And that kind of brings me back to where Yoan Moncada came up. And he was at one point, obviously, the number one prospect in baseball. And now you see him translate into a potential MVP candidate. Could you compare the two, Moncada and Robert, as they grew to the point where they are right now in their career?
Yeah, I mean, when Moncada was coming up, he was just an absolute, it's hard to compare him to people just because you don't have many guys that are built like him and have that kind of tool set, who can hit from both sides of the plate, who are, these dynamic power speed threats, but who can play. I mean, you could probably put Moncada second, third, center field. I think he could probably play. He's not really built like your classic center fielder, but he certainly has plenty of speed. And coming up through the junior leagues in Cuba, this guy always dominated. I mean, he was the best hitter in Cuba, his age group. He went to international tournaments, and as a teenager, and when scouts saw him there, they were like, "Oh my goodness, this is ridiculous! Like, who is this guy? We've You know, people were pretty excited about him. You know, I think Luis Robert certainly has some similarities there, where, you know, coming up through the Cuban junior leagues again, like Luis Robert was always probably the best player his age group. He was, you know, I think as a 16-year-old, I want to say, he was playing on their 18 and under junior national team for Cuba. So he was always a really high profile prospect coming up in Cuba. Very different body type. I mean, Moncada looks like he should be, you know, carrying a football on Sundays or something, whereas, you know, whereas Robert's more of that longer, lean athlete. You know, he's, I think, you know, that's something that kind of has, I don't want to say surprised me, but, you know, when Robert was younger, there was kind of a question, well, like, is this guy just going to get as big as a house and, you know, be more of a corner guy? But he's actually stayed very lean, very athletic. He's probably even faster now than he was in Cuba. So, yeah, I mean, two really, really great athletes, premium athletes with excellent tools and strong track records of hitting coming up in Cuba. And yeah, I mean, it's very, very different body types, obviously, but probably some similar risk factors too. And in some of the swing and miss, like, I think in Moncada's case, probably is a little bit more plate patience than Luis Robert does. I wouldn't call Robert necessarily like a free swinger or anything like that, but I think probably Moncada has a little bit more. I probably expect more walks to come with Moncada than with Luis Robert. But I mean, obviously, two really dynamic, tooled up athletes who've got a, you know, chance to be power speed threats for you.
You were mentioning something that kind of caught my interest when you mentioned how, you know, the scouting process internationally is unique, and you mentioned it even starts sometimes at 14 years old. Now, with the possibility of an international draft being implemented, that would obviously change things. How would you describe the impact of an international draft should it come to pass?
Yeah, I think the biggest impact right now is it would just slow everything down. It's, you know, it's at the point right now where, you know, teams are scouting, you know, eligible players, so players from the current 2019 class. You know, many of them are, you know, still 16, some of them 17 years old, you know, and, you know, there are still players out there who are, you know, 18, 19, basically the same age as, you know, high school seniors, players who will sign as, you know, draft picks in 2020, who are looked at as like older guys. But that's, you know, teams are trying to keep track of all these eligible guys for 2019. They're looking at 2020, but again, the reality is most of these top 2020 players pretty much know or have plans on where they're going to sign. Teams are keeping track of 2021, 2022. So you're trying to keep track of like 4+ years of players at once. So, you know, with a draft, that dramatically shifts how, you know, teams are going to be spending their time scouting players in Latin America. If, you know, if there's a draft, let's say, you know, they talked about moving the draft to August. So, if, you know, whether it's August, July, June, whatever, you know, you're basically the majority of your focus is just going to be on evaluating players who are, you know, either, I'm sure there'll be some free agency period, so either some, you know, for non-drafted players, so either players who are eligible to sign or players for the upcoming draft year. You're going to be focused on mostly 2020 players and trying to line those guys up on your board as best you can. And, you know, you might keep an eye on players for 2021 to a certain degree, just because when you're going out to different programs and, you know, scouting a 2020 player, you're going to see that program's, you know, players for the following year as well, probably. So, but it's really just to have a sense of who to follow for the next year. So, I mean, the biggest thing is it would just slow down that process immensely, which I certainly think would be a good thing. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, pros and cons to international draft, but I think anything that can slow this process down would be not better, not only for the clubs to be able to make better decisions, but but better for the players too, where, you know, it's tough to ask a kid to be ready to sign with a major league club when he's 14 years old. I mean, there's only so much strength you can have, and right. so much baseball skill and so many tools you can have. I mean, you know, you have guys who run, you know, 7.1, 7.2, below average runner at 14 years old, but that's not bad. He might be a plus runner by the time he's, you know, 16 years old. There's, you know, a kid that the Brewer signed this year who was, you know, 14. He was running 7.5 and now he runs 6.5. So, like, you know, shaving a full second off his 60 time, it's a jump of about three-ish grades maybe on his speed. So I think that would, you know, it'd be more beneficial for the player, certainly, at least in that sense, just to have a little bit more time to develop and not be having to be ready by the time you're, you know, 14 or even by the time you're like 14 years old or so. So I think that'll be certainly the biggest difference is slowing everything down. And then the other thing is it would very much change how teams scout in the sense that, you know, if, you know, the White Sox go in and they see, Christian Mena or somebody like that, and they say, oh, all right, I want that guy. Let's focus on him or let's try to, you know, get something done with him, you know, right now. All right, well, the draft, you really have to line up. I mean, depending on how many rounds it goes, you have to have, you know, I'm going to presume at least 100 plus, maybe more players lined up on your board. I mean, if we're talking about a 10 plus round draft, you better have at least, you know, 200, 300 or so players lined up, because that guy that, you know, whereas now you're just sort of focusing on the guys that you really like and you want to follow to try to make a deal with, you know, with a draft, you got to wait your turn and hope the guy who you like is there. And you just have to be a little bit broader in your coverage in terms of being able to make sure that you have the right guys lined up beyond just the top targets that you're really trying to bear down on.
All right, Ben. So I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the prospects at the lower levels of the White Sox system. One of the guys that you mentioned that we had our eye on throughout the year down in the DSL was Benjamin Bailey. He kind of broke out in the DSL this year, and the way the White Sox have been doing things lately, I think he likely plays stateside next year. What are your thoughts on him, and how was he so under the radar?
Yeah, we just posted a report on him and their international review, and I went down to the White Sox Academy to catch them during Dominican Instructional League in November. And, you know, you can, if you watch the video in that report, you can see this guy is absolutely enormous. I mean, he's like 6'5", 225 pounds. He's probably going to get even bigger and stronger. He's enormous. So it's hard to think, like, you know, how did this guy get like $35,000? I mean, he was not a big signing
from Panama, right? Yeah.
Yeah. From Panama. I didn't know who he was until, you know, what he started doing this year in the DSL and started hearing more about him. I mean, you look at his numbers and, leads the league in on base percentage. And I think if you just like look at his numbers on the surface without knowing anything about him, you'd think, oh, maybe like a nice, like, little player who, like, you know, draws walks and puts the bat to the ball and, gets, you know, occasional power. This guy is an absolute physical specimen. power, speed. I don't know how much of that speed he's going to retain. I mean, you can see he's just so big that I think he's going to slow down eventually. I mean, he's still 18 years old. By the time he's in his early mid 20s, he'll probably lose at least a step. But I think he's always going to run fairly well for just for his size and move around pretty well as a corner outfielder. But that's a really exciting player to get, especially for that price. And you know, he's a guy who went back and, you know, just looking at his the numbers that he had put up in Panama before signing. They have like a big junior national league in Panama, so there's a ton of like games that those kids play. You tend to find the Panamanian players have pretty good instincts and feel for the game just because they grow up playing a lot of organized baseball. And he, you know, he was one of the best hitters in that league. So not that it's, you know, great pitching there by any means. It's, you know, you don't see the kind of, you're not facing the kind of velocity that kids who are training every day in the Dominican Republic are facing every day, where they're, you know, facing, you know, mid upper 80s as 14, 13, 14 year old kids pretty regularly, and even guys throwing 90 plus. They don't have that kind of velocity in Panama, but he always hit well there. So it's, yeah, I mean, Panama is not as heavily scouted as the Dominican Republic, or, you know, obviously Venezuela has its challenges right now to scout those players. But, you know, I think certainly if you had put this kid in the Dominican Republic with the kind of tools that he has, and obviously with the benefit of hindsight, the kind of hitting ability that he has right now relative to his peers, I don't think there's much chance that he's only signing for $35,000. So for me, that was one of the more exciting kind of sleeper prospects that I think any club signed for a five figure type bonus in 2019, especially for a position player. I mean, I think you see a lot of cases where, you know, you sign a pitcher for, you know, 40 grand or 10 grand, and, you know, they're 87-90, and all of a sudden, boom, they're 90-94, maybe up to 95 pretty quick. And I think you find a lot of pitchers that way, but it's much more challenging, I think, to get those low dollar bargain position players like Bailey. So I think they did, we'll see what happens next year. Maybe he, you know, falls on his face completely, but so far a lot of arrows pointing in the right direction with him.
Yeah, it's certainly good to hear. There's a couple other guys in the DSL I just wanted to touch on. So catcher Jefferson Mendoza, he had a pretty good year, I think, in his second year down there last year, the catcher. And then somebody that you highlighted last year, 16-year-old lefty Ronaldo Guzman, actually struck out 76 over 51 innings last year. So what can you tell us about him, I guess, just like the stuff and how that projects?
Guzman, he's a good example of like more of like an under the radar type arm where it actually looked pretty good right away. I mean, in his case, it's I think it's more about pitchability, feel for pitching than raw stuff, or at least, you know, raw fastball. I think he's, you know, fastball, he's right around 90 miles an hour. It's not overpowering. You need to hope some more velocity comes with him, which it certainly could. He's young, he's got time to develop it. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it doesn't. We'll look for certain projection indicators on pitchers to see if that's gonna come, but sometimes you're just guessing to a certain extent. So we'll see what happens with that, but he's got good feel, I think, especially for pitching, and he's got some feel for his off-speed stuff too. Pretty advanced changeup, especially for his age, and he's got feel for spinning a breaking ball. So somebody like a Christian Mena, for example, might have a little bit more upside, I think, who they signed this year. But, you know, certainly in his case, obviously, you got to be encouraged with the results so far, and hopes that some more velocity comes around as he develops. And Mendoza, a guy repeating the Dominican Summer League, kind of a tough year his first season out, but you definitely like to see the progress that he made this season. So kind of wait and see on him.
Last one for me, Ben. Really appreciate the time. To round it out, how do you evaluate the White Sox facilities in the Dominican, and how would you say that they stack up against other teams that are in the area?
In terms of just the facility itself?
Yeah, the quality and the access.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of new or newer facilities in the Dominican Republic that are just beautiful. The Indians and the Giants, the Pirates is maybe a few years older now, but that's, you know, a really nice facility. So all these clubs that have been, building these new academies in the Dominican Republic are like, you know, very top of the line type facilities with a lot of different amenities for the players and for the staff there. You have some clubs that have academies that are a little bit older, but, you know, have been kept up pretty well. Teams are investing money, you know, the Padres, the Yankees that are, putting more money into them to, renovate them and stay up to, stay up to date with everything. And then there's kind of a collection of teams that, have more of a, bare bones type of academy. And that's probably the category I would put the White Sox into. There's a handful of other clubs that are, probably in that same boat. There's like a little area where there's, the White Sox, the Orioles, the Reds, the Diamondbacks and the Blue Jays are there as well in this area in Boca Chica called Baseball City. So it's definitely in terms of location, it's a very convenient location to have. You can have your DSL players basically walk to some of their road games, but just in terms of the facility itself, it's not one of these sparkly new facilities that a lot of the other clubs have. But so it's if I own the White Sox, it's definitely an area where I would want to invest. I think it would be a good investment for them to it's easy for me to spend somebody else's money, but I think it would be a good investment to try to build out their own facility and kind of upgrade what they do. It makes an impact both in terms of scouting. You can bring players in to evaluate them, and also for player development. Obviously, when you have all these guys in there for your Dominican Summer League guys and even other guys who are coming down to be there either to get ready for the season in the spring or before spring training, or who are there after the season for Dominican Instructional League. So it's, it benefits the players. It benefits the staff. I think it just benefits the whole organization. Ultimately it's a facility. What matters is, is the players that you're putting in there. But it's definitely more in the kind of the bare bones, I think, type facility where it's functional. There's nothing flashy about it, but if it were me, I'd definitely like to see them make an investment to upgrade what they have down there.
Yeah, Ben, we cover the draft in the international market, so we're fans of spending other people's money as well. So we agree there. This is my last one, and thanks again for coming on with us today. We really appreciate it. Is there anything you can tell us yet about the White Sox related to the 2020 upcoming period for next year? And is there another former international prospect in their system maybe that we haven't asked you about today that you're still high on going forward?
Like somebody else in the system right now, or
yeah, I guess like just somebody they've signed in the past, like a Mieses or Lennon Sosa, somebody we haven't talked about today, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I saw, I don't know, like, if he's ever gonna put it together, but like, I saw Anderson Comas when I was down at their academy for just, you know, he was there for Dominican instructional league, and like, you know, I liked him as an amateur, just, you know, a lot because of the body, and you know, I don't know if he ever puts it all together, but like, there's not many people in the world that look like Gregory Polanco physically. But he, you know, I don't know if he has that kind of speed necessarily, but like, he's just this big physical dude where like, if it ever all clicks for him, I think it's probably a long shot for that to happen. But you know, it's certainly, I can see why like he's probably gonna get a lot of chances. And then, you know, Christian Mena, who you know, I think I just briefly touched on earlier, but you know, you throw a whole bunch of arms, you know, I feel like I write up and a lot of pitchers, and it's a lot of the similar type report where a guy's, you know, 87, 91, some feel for an inconsistent breaking ball, scattered strikes. Like, you know, you see a lot of those same type profiles, and, you know, a few of them click and a lot of them don't. In Mena's case, I think you see a lot of positive projection indicators with the body, a lot of space to put weight on, 6'2", 170. It's a pretty free and easy type delivery. He's been up to 91, and he's got really good spin on a breaking ball. You know, some guys, it's you know, they struggle with the breaking ball that age, and a lot of guys just kind of like get around it. It ends up being more of a slurvy pitch, but in, you know, I think he still does that sometimes, just pretty normal, but just the feel for spin, the rotation on that pitch is pretty impressive. So, you know, of that big glob of pitchers every year that sign with the, you know, a lot of similar traits, I think just that feel for spin and a breaking ball definitely sticks out with him as a guy who's, you know, has that. He has athleticism. I think he's going to be a solid strike thrower too. You know, we'll kind of wait and see. I got a chance to see him at Dominican Instructional League for one very quick inning, cause he was very, very effective. Got a couple swings and misses against, Yasiel Antuna, who's I believe 19 or 20 now in the Nationals farm system. He was down there rehabbing one of their top 10 prospects. So he's a guy who, I mean, pitching in the draft, right? You know, pitching in the draft is always difficult for high school arms, and you can magnify that when you're taking off 2 years for a 16-year-old right-handed pitcher out of Latin America. But he's one guy who I'm pretty intrigued to see, you know, where the stuff is at in a couple of years with him.
That's Ben Badler joining us here on the Future Sox podcast from Baseball America. You can follow Ben on Twitter at Ben Badler, B-A-D-L-E-R. Ben, thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, absolutely. I always enjoy talking prospects, so thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks, Ben.
Subscribe to Ben and Baseball America. Well, you should subscribe to Baseball America to get Ben's information. Go to baseballamerica.com for all the information. That'll do it for this edition of the Future Sox podcast. For James Fox and for Ben Badler, my name's Mike Rankin. We will talk to you next time.